I'm off my game today.
No, you're not.
That's true.
People are going to have to start making better content.
I think we're going to be talking about this for a long time.
When you program for everyone, you program for no one.
I think it's that we're a purpose-driven platform. Like, we're trying to get to substance. How okay. was that? Are you happy with that?
Yeah.
This is marketing therapy right now.
It really is. Yeah.
What's up? I'm Laura Carenti.
And I'm Alexa Kristen. Welcome back, Edlandia. End of summer. It is hot and it's going to be hot in here. So our next guest this week needs no introduction.
None.
She is the woman of the industry. She's showing the industry how to think beyond the industry and how to rethink how we operate.
Really excited to hear from the one and only Cindy Gallup. We'll be right back. And we're back in the studio with Cindy Gallup. Cindy is the founder and CEO of Make Love Not Porn. We are so excited to have you.
Well, I'm deeply flattered.
So, Cindy, you obviously have a business that you have built in Make Love Not Porn. But before we get into that, you have such a storied career, and you've talked about on your Twitter, which is one of my favorite things to follow on the internet, about what it took for you to crack into advertising. Can you tell our listeners?
Well, I read English at university at Oxford and fell madly in love with theatre and decided that was all I wanted to work in. And so for several years, I was a theatre marketing and publicity officer in the UK. But eventually, I got completely bored with basically working 24/7 and earning chicken feed, which is what happens in the theatre. And at the time, I was the marketing officer at the Everyman Theatre in Liverpool. And part of my job promoting the theatre was to give talks about it. So I gave a talk to a group of women, and after it, one of them came up to me and said, "Young lady, you could sell a fridge to an Eskimo." And so I thought, okay, that is the universe telling me something. It's time to sell out to the establishment and go into advertising. But advertising was very difficult to get into. This was the UK back in the 80s. Advertising, believe it or not, was the hottest, sexiest, and most desirable career. And so I, first of all, I tried applying cold to a number of agencies. And I said, you know, I've been working in marketing publicity for a number of years. I can bring all of this experience to the table. And I found myself trapped in that, you know, double bind of they wouldn't hire me because I didn't have any experience in advertising, but I couldn't get any experience in advertising unless they hired me.
Right.
So I gave up on that and I decided that I would just have to go back and do the entry-level graduate trainee application thing, you know, several years late. I basically took a job at the first agency that offered me one, which was Ted Bates, and had a very happy time there. Then Saatchi's bought Bates, and I interviewed with two agencies specifically, BBH and JWT. And BBH basically were interviewing me for an account manager job on this big retail account. And it was all going frightfully well. And you know, everyone wanted me to join. And I was, and at the time, BBH was the hottest agency in town. And then I was told, Nigel Bogle, who is the account manager at BBH, mm-hmm. really likes to meet all the account managers, all the account people we hire. So it's just a formality. You know, you just need to come in and meet Nigel Bogle. So I went in and met Nigel Bogle, and it was one of those interviews where I got off on the wrong foot the minute I crossed the threshold. It went very badly. They did not offer me a job. I went, okay, fine. Went to JWT instead. From JWT, I went to GGT. And then 2 years in at GGT, I got a call from a headhunter saying they're looking for an account director at BBH. And I went, oh, no. You know, they don't want me. And headhunter, well, you know, there's a new head of account management. You know, why don't you just go and talk to them? You know, I went, okay, fine. You know. So I went and, you know, met with a whole bunch of people again. And they all liked me. And then I got the call saying, now I just need to come in and meet Nigel Bogle. I went, okay, it's all over. So I went over thinking, right, well, that's it. You know. And actually, Nigel walked into the room and he was holding a piece of paper. And he said to me, look at what I found. And I thought, oh, it's my resume from the last time round. And it wasn't. It was one of the letters I'd written from the theatre world all those years ago, applying cold. And the moment I saw it, I realised BBH had been one of the agencies I'd applied to, and they'd been the only one where the CEO, Nigel, had written back to me and explained very nicely that they didn't hire anybody without experience because they were too small at the time. But it had been a really nice reply. And the interview went very differently, and at the end of it, Nigel went, well, you know, everybody here wants you to join us, and I'm being blamed as the only person who stopped you joining us the last time around. Will you, you know, we're going to offer you a job, and I hope you take it. And so that was my saga of getting into BBH. And in fact, the entertaining thing was, after I joined, I had lunch with John Bartle. And I said to him, oh, you know, I've been trying to get in here for a very long time. And but you kept rejecting me. And he went, oh, no, Cindy. That wasn't us rejecting you. As I recall, you were too good for the job.
Is the Cindy Gallup that everyone knows and loves today, and also this powerhouse voice in the industry, that same person? Or did you hit a place in your career where your voice to yourself started becoming more known and more comfortable?
Yep. Nope.
Nope.
No. I mean, everything in my life and career has happened by accident. Hmm. Nothing's been intentional. And there were no moments of revelation, I'm afraid. It's very disappointing. I get asked this kind of thing a lot.
That's actually a good thing, because I actually think that's real. That's the real. That's the reality.
And maybe that's why it works so well.
Maybe that's why it works so well. Coming here today, I was thinking about just some of my career. Realizing that, yes, I have these moments, but at the end of the day, everything's been kind of this non-linear,
exactly,
right, which is serendipitous thing.
So at some point you hit sort of the end of your agency track and decided you were going to transition into building.
Tell us the story. That was completely accidental as well. As a thrusting, ambitious young account director does, I pinned Nigel Bill up against the wall and I went, where am I going in this agency? And Nigel did the very good management tactic of turning the question back on me. And so he said, you tell us where you want to go and what you want to do, Cindy, and we'll make it happen. And he said, don't be bounded by the realms of the possible. Mm. If you want a job that does not yet exist, tell us what it is. Mm. So I thought, okay, you know, can't say fairer than that. Went off, thought about it, came back and said, okay. And bear in mind, at the time, we had one office in London. I said, my dream job is running BBH North America. And I said, and I'd be prepared to do that in San Francisco. And the reason I said that was because we had the Levi's business in Europe, and they were headquartered in San Francisco. They're important for us. And I said, but to be my true dream job, I'd be doing it in New York. And so Nigel went, okay. He said, actually, we have started talking about the US. You know, not sure how they'll go, but your request is logged. So I went out to BBH Asia Pacific as the number two. And then in 1998, I got my dream job. I came out here to start up BBH New York. So, you know, did that for a number of years, around the agency for a number of years. Then in 2005, turned 45, had my very own personal midlife crisis, in the sense that I'd always thought of 45 as kind of a midlife point. Mm. Obviously, by the way, in the happy assumption, one lives to be 90, fingers crossed. But I'd always gone, on your 45th birthday, that is the moment when you should pause, take stock, reflect and review. Where have I been? Where am I going? So on February 1, 2005, I duly did that. And that was the moment in which I went, oh my God, I've just worked 16 years for the same advertising agency. Absolutely amazing agency. I honestly cannot say enough nice things about BBH. I love them to death. But I went, whoa, maybe it's time to do something different. And then the problem was, I hadn't the faintest idea what. Because I'd always said to people, I'm not going to work in advertising forever. I'm not going to work at BBH forever. But advertising is a very good industry to work in to find your next thing, because you come into contact with so many different sectors, people, companies, businesses. So I guess I'd always thought that my next big thing would kind of bubble up from the ether one day. Mm-hmm. And there I was at the age of 45 and it hadn't. So lots of thought and angsting ensued. And eventually I went, if I want to examine every possible option open to me for what is effectively the second half of my life, maybe the best thing to do is to put myself on the market very publicly and go, okay, guys, here I am, what do you got? And see what comes. So I took a massive leap into the unknown. I resigned as chairman of BBH in the summer of 2005 without a job to go to. As I suspected and surmised, a ton of approaches were made to me, 90% of which I would never have thought of myself. Mm. You know, and so I went, okay, still don't know what I want to do. I'm going to be an employment slut. I'm going to talk to everybody. Hmm. I'm going to take every meeting. I'm going to do every phone call, no preconceived notions. And so I embarked on this fascinating exploratory, which was as good for telling me what I didn't want to do as what I did want to do.
Can I just stop there? Mm. That is huge advice. I talk to a lot of friends about this who are hemming and hawing about the next move, whether it's the next job or it's the next career move. And what you just said was stop thinking so much. Yep. Just do.
Yep.
Nope. Just go in, do. And that's like, yep. Yeah, that's no, the secret.
No, exactly, exactly. And also, I mean, you know, a couple of important things I think too are, I mean, I was lucky. I had some BBH shares, which you had to sell when you left the company because it was a private company. So I knew I had a bit of a financial cushion that meant that I could take the time to explore. I mean, I recommend trying to accumulate that, you know, savings-wise or side hustle-wise.
Yep.
Because to be frank, you cannot make your next career decision when you're working 24/7. You are just never going to. You need to clear your head. You need to take the time to work out what you really want to do. And also, you need to say, I'm available. And when you put yourself out there, you'll be amazed at what comes to you that would not have come to you if they had not known that you were out there and open to talking. But I especially, to be frank, evangelicize about working for yourself. Because that is the only way to be. People make the mistake of thinking that a job is the safe option. It's not.
That's right.
In a job, you're at the complete mercy of management changes, market downturns, industry dynamics. You know, I always say to people, whose hands would you rather place your future in? Those of a large corporate entity who at the end of the day doesn't give a shit about you, or somebody who will always have your best interests at heart, i.e. you.
Yeah.
And so I recommend to people that they consider starting their own business. I especially recommend it to women because the existing industry is not working for us. We need to redesign and reinvent our own.
Yeah.
And in fact, the closing keynote I gave at the 3% conference 2 years ago was, here are the 10 easy micro actions you can take to start your own agency now. And I made the point that I used the word agency in quotation marks because I don't mean start an agency like any of the ones you see around you today.
Right.
I mean start something that gives you agency.
That's right.
That lets you decide how you want to work, what you want to do, what you want your output to be, and then start that.
The thing is that I think it's not easy, but not to be mistaken that it's not doable.
Okay, I'm a big fan of radical simplicity. First of all, you know, what I say to everybody is just take a long, hard look around you and identify what you think is missing from our industry or from whatever industry you want to start something up in. You know, identify what you would love to be there that is not, what is not there that you could bring to the table, what you think the industry could really benefit from, but nobody else has spotted that, and then start that.
Yes.
And there is so much opportunity when you do that, especially through the female lens.
Yes.
And then, you know, there are a couple of good things about our industry. I mean, first of all, you don't have to jump ship and do it immediately. You can absolutely begin doing it in the form of a side hustle. Secondly, you know, depending on the nature of your business, the combination of, you know, service industry, it's you and your brain working from home, plus all your friends in your network and their brains, as and when you can call on them when you have a contract, plus a lot of these days free technical tools that enable you to build and structure and put out there anything you want. I mean, starting your own business could not be easier, especially given the nature of what we do.
Right.
And incidentally, this is another reason why I say to all women, and actually people of colour, anybody who is other in our industry, you have to go to the 3% conference. Okay, this year it's in Chicago, November 8th, 9th. I'll be giving the closing keynote again. But the reason you have to go there is because there are your clients. There are your contacts, your network, I mean, your future employees, your co-founding partners. But there are the people who want to give you business when you start your own agency, company, doing something that is not available in the industry currently. Following all my years in our industry, I feel very strongly the future of business is doing good and making money simultaneously. And I believe it's very important in that context to design new business models. And so I believe the business model of the future is shared values plus shared action equals shared profit, financial profit and social profit. In other words, when brands and businesses and companies come together with their audiences, and by the way, that can be your consumers, your employees, your analysts, you know, whatever audience it is. When you come together around values that you all share, which, by the way, is the most important requirement for good relationship in life as much as business.
Yep.
You'll never truly bond with someone if you don't share the same values.
Right.
When you come together around shared values, when you are then collaboratively and collectively enabled to co-act on those values, to walk the talk together, you can then make things happen in the real world that will benefit consumers, benefit society, and benefit the brand and its business. And so I started a company called If We Ran the World, which is co-action software designed to help brands implement that business model.
What is that? It's actually software?
I call If We Ran the World marketing enterprise software, because mm-hmm. that's what it's intended to be. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of brands see the future of advertising marketing as co-creation mm-hmm. with their consumers, and I see it as co-action. Mm-hmm. And so it basically enables you to take any goal, break it down into micro-actions. Mm-hmm. A micro-action is an incredibly small, simple, easy-to-do action, which is so easy, why wouldn't you do it?
I want to say, for our listeners too, like an action, define an action in this case.
So my philosophy, and by the way, you know, I live my own philosophies. I design my startups around them. And so my philosophy is one of micro-actions. So as I said, a micro-action is an incredibly small, simple, easy-to-do action, which is so tiny and easy to do, why wouldn't you do it? And the reason micro-actions are important is because I believe that change happens from the bottom up, not the top down.
That's right.
Every single one of us, every single day, undertaking tiny micro-actions to change what we want to see change cumulatively, add up at scale to enormous impact. I mean, one micro-action can start a chain reaction that can change the world. So If We Ran the World enables you to break any goal into micro-actions that can be shared out amongst different communities, different audiences, within businesses and within brands, so that you can all co-act to achieve the goal together.
Can you imagine like a media plan? You say, this is not a media plan. This is a set of micro-actions. Like,
It's a new model to solve a brief.
The way we've been, right,
guys,
talking about it, but we haven't coined it as micro actions, which is completely subverts the bullshit of goals that we've been talking about need to be subverted and changed.
No, you're absolutely right. And actually, the interesting thing for me was that when I was sharing If Around the World in concept form with a venture capitalist, this is years ago, he said to me, Cindy, you've created the advertising agency of the future. And I had not thought about it like that.
Right.
And actually, I mean, first of all, I was enormously flattered when 12 months into If We Ran the World released in beta, Harvard Business School contacted me and said, this model is so innovative, we want to write it up as a case study and teach it.
Wow.
So I had the extraordinary, surreal experience of going to Harvard, sitting in the back of a lecture theater, watching my 12-month-old startup being taught to a class of business students. And so it exists as a Harvard Business School case study.
Okay,
and so
amazing.
I hear from business students all around the world about it. I very much want to go back and reactivate If Around the World when I can. I need to find brand partners and investors. But the world still needs what that startup is all about.
That actually seems like the sort of strategic media lens or planning lens that needs to be put on top of the blockchain. For those people who have this up and trying to figure out, like, how do we move through the tech element, you have sort of that strategic lens. So
talk about Make Love, Not Porn.
Sure.
How did that happen?
Again, by complete accident. Mm. I date younger men. They tend to be men in their 20s. And about 10 or 11 years ago, I began realizing through dating younger men that I was encountering what happens when today's total freedom of access to porn online meets our society's equally total reluctance to talk openly and honestly about sex. Mm. When those two dynamics converge, porn becomes sex education by default in not a good way. Mm-hmm. So I decided something about this. 9 years ago, put up a very small, clunky, no-money website at makelovenotporn.com that was just myth versus reality, porn world versus real world. Launched at TED back in 2009, became the only TED speaker to say the words, come on my face, on the TED stage, 6 times.
I think, and probably still, by the way,
undoubtedly.
I don't think you had any followers after saying that.
The talk went viral, and it basically triggered this huge global response to my tiny, clunky site that I'd never anticipated. And I realized I'd uncovered a huge global social issue. And so I felt a responsibility to do something about that. And I saw the opportunity to do exactly what I believe in, which is do good and make money simultaneously. So I saw the opportunity for a big business solution to this huge untapped global social need. And I use the word big advisedly because even then, back in 2009 at concept stage, I knew that if I wanted to counter the global impact of porn as default sex ed, I was going to have to come up with something that had the potential one day to be just as mass, just as mainstream, and just as all-pervasive in our society as porn currently is.
Right.
So I was thinking big right from the get-go. And so that led me to take Make Love Not Porn forwards as makelovenotporn.tv, which is the world's first and only social sex video sharing platform that celebrates real-world sex as a counterpoint to porn in order to socialize sex, to make it easier to talk about for everyone in the world in order to promote good sexual values and good sexual behavior. We call ourselves the social sex revolution. The revolutionary part is not the sex, it's the social.
It's dovetailed, like you said, your principles and your beliefs have dovetailed into, and you're speaking. It's like all of these things actually line up very, very well. It's her agency, 100%, into being one of the loudest voices in the industry for industry change around equality, let's call it at the highest level, right, for everyone. Sexual harassment, you have been one of the loudest voices. Was it Make Love Not Porn? Was it, you know, your belief system? Was it everything that made you this kind of the one who had to, or one of the, you know, big people in the industry who had to step up and call it out?
Nothing so intentional. Speaking up about Me Too was kind of an accident as well. I mean, it's not in the sense that I had deliberately been speaking up about sexual harassment in business for years,
right,
way before the Me Too movement, essentially because nobody else would, you know.
Right.
And, you know, I would make a point of including it in every single business talk I gave, no matter to whom, no matter how corporate the environment. And I would say to the audience, you know, this is a huge, sexual harassment is a huge business issue. I would say every single woman in this room knows what I'm talking about. None of the men do. At the last minute, I rewrote my 3% conference closing keynote of last year. And the topic I'd meant to talk about, it was called Where the Money Is. And having spent the previous year telling women and people of color to start their own agencies, my talk was meant to be about the areas you can start agencies in that will really make you money. And I pushed that into the back, and I made the front half of the talk all about what I'd realized with this avalanche. And I said to the audience, I've changed my own thinking. Because up to this point, I thought diversity was the single biggest business issue facing our industry. I realize it's not. Sexual harassment is. Because sexual harassment is keeping out of leadership the female leaders who would actually welcome in gender equality, diversity, and inclusion. And as long as sexual harassment keeps women out of power, we will never be gender equal, diverse and inclusive. And so we absolutely have to solve that issue above all others before we solve anything else.
What's your perspective on what needs to happen, whether micro actions or kind of bigger organizational changes to change this behavior, but also to change, it really does come down to an org structure as well, right? It comes down to hard org structures. What does that look like in your mind?
No, absolutely. So this is why I take issue with Sheryl Sandberg, because Sheryl Sandberg wants us to lean in within the existing system, and I want us to redesign the system. And I'm very frank about this on the stage at the 3% conference every year. I've given up trying to make organizational change happen in our industry. My call now to women, to people of color, to disabled people, to older people, to LGBTQ people is start your own agency. The white male ecosystem is not working for us. We have to start our own ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And the opportunities are enormous when we do, because, you know, our entire industry is fucked. That closed loop of white guys talking to white guys about other white guys is not taking it anywhere. And the downfall of the holding companies and the downward trajectory of their share price just demonstrates that. The opportunity is enormous for our new models. I've been saying for years that I want to see the female-founded holding company of the future.
Yeah.
Because
it
will look very different.
It?
Oh, yes. I've just been talking to another woman in our industry who is determined to do this, has a very interesting model. I've told her I think the idea is brilliant. and I will give her all the help I can to make that happen. And she was second guessing herself. Right. I mean, she was giving me ideas that nobody else is having, and she was second-guessing herself because she's been so beaten down by all the men telling her she's crazy over the years that, you know, this is a worrying thing. And so I'm trying to encourage all the women, people of colour, people who are considered other in our industry, start your own industry because it's eminently possible and it'll make you a shit ton of money.
Do you believe in, like, cultural training? So a lot of big companies will go into, like, sexual harassment training, equality training. Like, are you, silent biases, things like that. Do you believe in training? Or how do you think these types of things that you're talking about really get a foothold and matriculate through an organization that already exists?
So I am dying for organizations to hire me as a consultant in this context because all that training does absolutely nothing, okay, for a couple of reasons. And by the way, what I'm about to say is backed up by loads of research. First of all, sad fact of life, the more a company talks about diversity, talks about inclusivity, talks about what it's doing around gender equality, the more you alienate the societal norm, white men. They get actively angry and alienated and do not wish to help with any of that. So it doesn't help you in trying to change the culture.
Right.
Secondly, fundamental human nature. If we feel we are doing something virtuous in one area, we feel it gives us an excuse to engage in a vice in the other. Mm. So the very mundane everyday example is, you know, I'm having a Diet Coke so I can eat the bag of chips. Mm. And the danger again with a company going blah, 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 diversity, diversity, diversity is people go, oh, right, so we've got diversity covered off over there. I can just carry on recruiting the same biased way I always have. So I have plenty of ideas, and I'm dying to implement with the right brave company. Our creative philosophy at BBH was, I don't sell, I make people want to buy. I'm not selling diversity, I'm making people want to buy it. Yeah. I want us to basically bring to bear all of what we're good at, human insight, psychological understanding, extremely ingenious strategy and highly creative execution to create programs that will absolutely drive cultural change without the people in the culture even realizing they're changing.
Is there work that you can point to in the marketplace right now that signals when all of these things are working in the way they ought to be, that you can point to and say, this would be an example? When you have other at the table, this is a manifestation of what can happen.
I'm going to give you, you know, what I think is the best possible example in response to that, which is Hamilton. Mm. Because basically, you know, when you have at the top of an industry a closed loop of white guys talking to white guys about other white guys, the creative output you get is Batman versus Superman, which tanked the box office. When you invite women and people of color into the room where it happens, advisedly, then what you get is Hamilton, which has not only exploded every creative convention of the Broadway musical.
That's right.
Created a completely new theatrical phenomenon, but is not coincidentally making literally billions of dollars. But the really important thing about Hamilton is that it is diverse through and through.
That's right.
You know, the team who created it, the writer, the composer,
right.
Everybody, you know, it's not just what you see on stage. Every single thing about it is other, which is why it is unlike anything else theatrically, musically that's ever been.
The world needs more others.
Yeah.
That's right. Cindy, before we let you go, we have a game we like to play, Kill by DIY. Cindy Gallup, what would you kill?
I would kill the patriarchy. I would buy anything created through the lens of someone who is other. And, you know, if I weren't already working on my own $1 billion venture, I would undoubtedly start the female-founded holding company of the future.
I love it. Cindy Gallup.
If people want to get in touch with you, to hire you,
to talk to you,
get advice from you, where can they reach you?
Cindy@ifweranthewell.com. You can follow me on Twitter @CindyGallup, and you can find me on LinkedIn, Cindy Gallup again, and on Facebook, Cindy Gallup.
Can you change, when you go back to ifweranthewell.com, can you change it to when we run the world?
We will.
Fabulous. Cindy Gallup.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Big thanks to Cindy Gallup. The way she kind of simply put things was really refreshing. And I think that it's not just for the individual, right? It's not just for female or quote unquote the others. It's for brands. It's for startups who are thinking about how they're getting into a space and who they want to be and how they're going to sell and how they're going to open up a market and a position for themselves. I think it always goes back to those values and running those values through every single thing that you are, that you do, that you sell, that you say, that you hire. And she said it, I think, kind of impeccably.
So make sure to follow Cindy Gallup. She has one of our favorite Twitter handles in the industry. Big thank you to our producer, Dana.
Matt Turk, Andy Bowers, Jacob Weisberg, all of our friends and family at Panoply.
We'll be back in 2 weeks. Full disclosure, our opinions are our own.